And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we talk about Planet X, that strange planet, some say, way out there in the solar system that comes around every 3,600 years and plays havoc with planet Earth. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Let me tell you a little bit about Gordon James Gianinotto, attorney, contractor, ET contactee. Gordon has had, since his childhood, many UFO and ET encounters. He first saw his first UFO in 1964, claiming it was a one-mile diameter mothership launching three saucers over San Juan, Puerto Rico Harbor. He had his first vision of a pole shift in 1973 and a very long and detailed dream, and had a waking vision of the same thing in 1988. He realized a pole shift would soon bring open contact with DTs. Stand by for this on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Gordon James, how are you, Gordon?
Oh, I'm fine, George, and I'm so glad to be here. This is my absolutely favorite show. I've listened to you since day one of when the show started, and then from day one of you, too. So,
well, welcome aboard. You have had a very varied career, attorney, contractor. Tell me all about you. Tell me more than just the bio.
Well, I feel I've done as much as other people do in three lifetimes, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it is about other people, but I'm one of those. I'm interested in everything. I've never had a bored moment in my life, and I only sleep about 4 hours a night usually. So, this is not difficult for me to be talking to you now and from Maine. But I just see that other people, you know, life is like a ball, and some people pick it up and run with it, and other people just sit there wondering what the heck's happening. So, you know, it's each to his own. I think the creator allows everybody to go at their own speed. But I've just been fascinated with space. And for all the things that I've done, they really don't, you know, you don't put on a resume the things that really mean the most to me.
No.
And my whole life I've had people say, well, why don't you get a job like a normal person? And I'm thinking, well, I was born a couple hundred of years early, I thought, but now I don't think so. But you know, and that's because I can be one of those that can really give some people some inspiration. So that's what I've been trying to do.
And, you know, you've seen these visions now of some big changes that are about to happen. We're going to go through a lot of
this. Absolutely.
But a lot of this happened to you when you were a child. And I'm convinced, Gordon, that childhood events mold us as we get older. Describe your childhood experiences for us.
Well, you know, a lot of people remember things from their childhood, and I don't remember much, but I'll tell you, there's one thing I will never forget. And it was a warm summer afternoon. I was about 5 years old, and some people came into my room, and they took me. My mother was taking a nap. My brother was taking a nap. I was taking a nap. I was five. He was one. And these adults came and took me, and I didn't really know where I went. But when I got there, I was an adult, and it was a big council meeting. And we were discussing the future of something really big, like a planet or a civilization. There were, you know, hundreds of people there. And I was there, gone for 3 days. And I really, you know, I didn't know who took me or where I went, but I was an adult, and that was natural. I didn't, you know, I just didn't have any problem with that. So when I woke up, I told my mother, and she goes, oh, no, that's a dream. And I said, no, I'm telling you, someone took me somewhere for 3 days. And she's like, well, that's impossible. And right there, I knew that there was another side to life that people, you know, weren't going to discuss, and that things can happen to you that other people can't understand or explain. So, and it just went from there. I mean, we grew up, we were 7 miles from the nearest traffic light. We were as far in the woods of Western Connecticut as you can be.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, my parents were divorced, and my brother and I lived in the house with my mother, and we each had our own bedroom. We were all be asleep, and all of a sudden, it was just like the house was in the middle of the outfield of Yankee Stadium during a night game. It was a white light that just... And, you know, we would all three of us would get up. And that, to me, shows that we probably had been somewhere on a ship, and they had just brought us back and let us see that light, so that there was that little key into the conscious mind that if you wanted to work on it later, you could. Well, my brother and mother weren't interested, but I just knew there was more to it. And you remember back, you know, I was born in 1948. In the 50s, they had all those science fiction movies where people were getting messages from Mars on their shortwave radio and things like that. I mean, I would knock people over to watch those movies on TV. And one day,
did your mother witness all this with you? Was she a believer?
Well, yeah, she doesn't know what to say. But she's very supportive. That's the best part about it. Is my brother's supportive to an extent. You know, George, you can't be a prophet in your own family. I mean, in your own country.
Yeah.
And sometimes the people that think they know you best, when you start talking about stuff like this, thinking, well, I didn't see it. You know, I don't know. Where'd you get that? You know, and it couldn't be right. And you find that, you know, people around the world are interested in what you have to say, but maybe your neighbors aren't. So I'm used to that now. But no, she would say, well, that was a meteor shower or something. So it wasn't, you know, we weren't saying that we didn't see the light, but we didn't see a ship. But, you know, where to place that together. And then we were on vacation and, well, I got to say, my father is a very famous, well-known person who's dead now, but he founded two fields, package design and industrial design. And he was a very unusual person. He worked his way up to the creative director of BBDO, and the stock market crashed, and he went to the directors, and he goes, I've got an idea. He goes, you know, we do advertising. He goes, these products look like hell. He goes, and the packages they come in look even worse. He said, you know, let's make sure the product works, but then let's design it so that when the minute somebody sees it, they want to touch it. Good. They go home and they dream about it. They can't get it out of their mind. They're not going to be satisfied. And this product is going to fix everything in their lives. Their whole focus is on it. And he said, then let's create a package where even at 300 yards, you know what product it is and you know what it stands for. And he goes, and then when we go to advertise, we're going to be so successful. And
genius, you know, simple, but a genius. You know what?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the partners at BBDO said, well, you know, Frank, because his name was Francesco, but they changed it at Ellis Island. And so it was Frank. Yeah. Said, Frank, you know, someday maybe, but it's the Depression. We can't do that. And so my father said, no, you know, I think I really am here. So he goes, I'm going to resign and I'm going to contact all of your clients and tell them what I'm going to do. And so he did that, and he had never gone on vacation. He came over when he was 11 years old, and I mean, 8 years old in 1908. And he thought, well, I'll go to Florida. I've never been to Florida. And when he came back, he couldn't even open his office door. There was so much mail. And his first two clients were DuPont and Flint Coat Paints or something.
Amazing. Yeah.
But the most famous thing he did was he invented the flip-top box for cigarettes, and he did the package for Marlboro.
He did those.
So that is the single most valuable brand in the world. And when he did the package, it was a white package with scrolls, sort of like the Duke of Marlboro, and not many people smoked it. And if they did, they were only women. And he designed it to be a mountain. When men look at the Marlboro package, they see a mountain. And when women look at it, they see a house.
That's perfect.
And the day it came out, it went to number one in the world, and it's stayed there since.
So you had an exposure to creativeness in the family. And
extreme.
Now, did your father know what was happening to you? Did he say, Gordon, you've got a vivid imagination here?
Oh, I think he said that you're Catholic, or that you were Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I am
Catholic, but I don't practice it a lot.
Okay, my father was Catholic, and my mother was his third wife. He went on to have two more after that. So he wasn't very successful in marriage, but that's because he put all of his energy into his career, and that sort of molded my opposite point of view, which is that there's no way you can have a happy life at home if you're always traveling. So that was my theory. But anyway, you know, he got divorced and he got excommunicated, and that was probably around 1930 or 35. And he goes, well, how in the hell can God kick you out of church? He's thinking, well, what does that mean? So he instantly, because he did have such an expansive creative mind, he's like, well, I've got to find out what's going on here. So he looked into Edgar Cayce, and he became a member of the ARE, mm-hmm. and he was actually friends with Edgar Cayce, and he was quite advanced. I mean, even in the 1950s, he would take one of those Wallensack tape recorders with him, and he'd go out to San Francisco to see a famous psychic, and he would get a reading and do a tape recording of it and bring it back and have his secretary type up a transcript. Well, I have a transcript from a 1956 reading one about me, and the first thing the woman said is, buy this boy a boat.
A boat?
Yeah, I love the ocean, and I've worked on commercial fishing boats. I love sailboats, canoes, you name it. I love the water.
And so by buying you a boat, that was what? For you to grow up and, you know, turn it into a business or what?
No, not to turn into business, just that was something. See, my father had rickets as a child, so he had trouble walking. And he was older. He was 45 years older than I was. So, but the thing is in that interest he had in what's the meaning of life, he got interested in UFOs. So he when he founded his package design company, he founded it in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, Tokyo, and Munich, Germany.
Wow, he went all over the place.
And he learned to, I mean, he's done everything. Even today, I mean, I don't, you know, anyone that's listening to the show, I doubt they're more than 100 feet from some Marlboro package. You know, it's just so ubiquitous. And the thing
you know, and at least he invented the package, not necessarily the cigarette, right?
Right. And he did Dole pineapple, Lipton soup. I mean, and just all these products in other countries. And at the end of his life, he was an advisor on international marketing to the Red Chinese government and the Soviet Union. So whenever he would go on a trip, we had all these people come up in black limousines and ask where he was, and it was funny. But you know, he wasn't a suspicious character by any means, and he had a great sense of humor. But you know. And this is why, one of the reasons why I'm here is because of something in your family. And what it is you remember your aunt, Dr. Shafika Karagula?
Yep, sure do.
And the Biometric Research Institute in Los Angeles?
Yep.
Did you ever go there and get tested?
I never got tested. I met her there once, and then she died shortly after that, I believe.
Well, I had never met her, but I met her partner, Dr. Viola Pettit-Neal.
You did?
And, yes, and Dr. Viola Pettit-Neal and her husband had invented earlier, probably about, I don't remember exactly, but 1920 perhaps, a way to measure intelligence using brainwaves. And then she invented a way to measure how much of it you were using. So now my father is president of a worldwide corporation. In his interest that I just told you about, UFOs, psychics, reincarnation, all of that, he heard about Dr. Viola Pettit-Neal, and he went and was tested. And he was tested to have an IQ of 210, and he was using it as if he had an IQ of 135.
That's amazing.
So she had a concentration exercise, which if you did, would teach you how to focus your mind and allow you to use, you know how they say, well, you only use 10% of your brain. Well, he achieved 100% use because he went back and was tested. So he was telling me that. And then I went to her in 1970, and I was tested, and I was tested to have an IQ of 200.
That's beyond genius.
Well, yeah, it's pretty creative. But, you know, to say that you're twice as smart as the average person is not saying much. And believe me, I do meet people, plenty of people that are smarter than I am. But, you know, I think everybody is a unique soul and has a unique contribution to make to life that no other soul can make. And so it never surprises me that no matter who the person is, no matter how smart or stupid they are, no matter what's right or wrong with them, there's always something to learn from somebody else. And that's one of the reasons why I love people, because you just never know when you are going to learn something from somebody else.
Well, when the aunt and Dr. and Neil got together, Dr. Neil, I mean, they were unbelievably successful in testing people. I mean, they were.
Well, I mean, what a story. I mean, they tested 35,000 people, and the most intelligent person she ever tested was General Rommel under Hitler with an IQ of 270.
270?
Yeah. So, but when we are born into these hybrid Zeta buddies in our next lifetime, we're going to all have IQs of 300. We're all going to be telepathic, and we're all going to live 400 years. I mean, I tell that to people, and people think, well, you know, I don't want to be like half alien, or I don't want to be in another body, and you know, they just can't picture it. But you know, you've had so many guests on that discuss reincarnation, and I don't remember all of my lifetimes, but I remember enough of them that it's just like somebody else remembers last week. And they're not all great. I made some mistakes and paid for it with whole lifetimes of difficult circumstances. But I do remember lifetimes that bear on this lifetime, you see. So that's what you really remember. If you stand back and look at all of your lifetimes, they would look like grains of sand on an endless beach. So there's some part of you that exists outside of your body. And just like if a new Mercedes were made and you had the money, you might go buy a new model Mercedes and gladly give up your old Studebaker. You know, why wouldn't you do that with a body? If you became more and more capable, you became a better artist, a better speaker, a better writer. You became more empathetic. You were kinder. You were more creative. Why wouldn't you want a body that it was easier to use to express that?
All right. Well, when we come back from the break, Gordon, I want you to tell us about this experience in San Juan Harbor in 1964. Just a truly incredible.
I would go ahead. Oh, it was unbelievable. So.
All right. We'll do that. And if you need to email me, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. coasttocoastam.com. And this whole episode, how did you get involved in the Planet X part, Gordon?
Well, I figured all this out on my own. You know, I read Zechariah Sitchin. I taught myself, this is the thing I want to do tonight, is I want to tell everybody a single thing I did that any of you couldn't do yourself, and maybe even better, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. So I learned, you know, when I taught myself how to tell if something's a lie or something's true. And when people talk to me, I just know whether it's true or not. And when I read something, I know if it's true or not. And I have this tremendous sense of common sense. And I know what goes with what. And I was reading Zechariah Sitchin, and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, this explains everything. All these ancient manuscripts, these myths, these stories, everything. And then, of course, it comes back. And I had read Velikovsky, and you name it. You know, these things happen. So it was not really difficult for me, but in 2006, after all I had done on my own, I was lecturing about pole shift, consciously contacting ETs, unselfishness, and I said, well, who's saying the same thing that I'm saying? And I looked around, and the only one that was saying it was Zeta Talk.
Yeah, that's true, at that time. And then others jumped on after.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, how many people have read most or all of the Edgar Cayce 14,000 readings, life readings? I have.
Not a lot. That's right. I think one of the mistakes that the Zeta Talk made was the predictions of a specific date. That's always the dangerous part, Gordon, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I didn't, I guess that was in 2003, and I'm not going to.
Yes, that's
you
right.
Know,
May of 2003.
I didn't know about it then, and I'm not going to make excuses for it, and I don't understand why it happened or whatever. But I want to tell you that I've been following everything, and I've gotten to know Nancy's leader, who is telepathically giving messages from the human Zetas. These are not just little unselfish or dangerous. George, the one thing I've learned is the
well,
same.
Hold on, Gordon. We're going to take this break and come back. And I like Nancy. She's been on the program after that. We'll be back in a moment with Gordon James Giannini Noto on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk about Planet X. We're going to talk about pole shift. And much more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Gordon James Gianni Noto as we talk about Planet X, the pole shift, and some other areas. Let's go back to 64, Gordon. Tell us about this huge ship that you apparently sent here.
I want to say that my father grew up poor, and he always said, someday when I die, it'll be all yours and your brothers and your sister, and until then, you're going to work. So I started working when I was 11, and the very first thing I bought was a telescope. And I used to spend all night outside looking at the moon and the stars and the planets. So I started building model airplanes and rockets. And so here we are. I'm 15 years old. We're down in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and we're on vacation. We go to the Bacardi rum factory. Of course, my mother loved drinking. I don't drink at all because I think it interferes with psychic ability, but, you know, everyone for himself. But it's helped me a lot to not be drinking, let me just say that. So anyway, we're at the Bacardi rum factory. We're coming back. We're the last tour to take it, and it's dark, and everybody in there, I think we were the only guests, the tourists, and everybody else was workers from Bacardi, and they're on this ferry going back to San Juan, because if you've been to San Juan, the Bacardi factory is, I don't know whether it's an island or what it is, but you have to take a ferry to it. So we're sitting on the upper deck of the ferry. It's a clear, starlit night, and we're looking up, and we're just thinking about, you know, our vacation, and I see this little gray P-shaped cloud suddenly appear in the sky next to a star, and I'm like, well, that's strange, and then I'm watching it, and it grew bigger and bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden, it sort of like had this orange glow, like maybe the sun was going to rise in the middle of the sky. Yeah. And I said to my brother and sister, my mother, look at that. So we all sitting there looking at this thing, and it just grew bigger and bigger. And then there was the little gray spot turned out to be like a contrail, like a big W, and right sort of in a script W. And in the central loop, this big orange thing sort of just appeared, like it gradually winked in as if you had a dimmer, and it was there, but what it did was just suddenly materialize, but slowly. And it was the most incredible thing floating in the sky. It was like the top half of a grapefruit. It was circular on the bottom, hemispherical on the top, and it was as if it were made from white milk glass, and it had an orange light bulb in the center. So you could not see any detail, but there was this hemispherical mothership. I mean, it was huge. It was like, it was bigger, apparently, you know, if you were to hold your arm at arm's length and your finger next to the full moon, it was bigger than that. So we're looking at that thinking, well, what's next? And all of a sudden, a door that you couldn't see until it opened on the side, and a flying saucer came zooming out straight out over the Atlantic. And it wasn't zooming like thousands of miles an hour. It was probably doing like 100 miles an hour. Small. And then a second one right behind it, and then a third. Then the door closed, and then you couldn't see any more detail on it. And then by then, the wind had sort of distributed this white contrail. So it really looked like a sunrise or a sunset with a cloud in front of it. And then it slowly just sat there and dimmed out. And I'm like, oh, my God, because, you know, with all my interest in astronomy, and my mother and brother go, well, that was interesting, but what's for dinner? And I said, what's for dinner? You got to be kidding. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm studying. Another thing is, I was selected as one of the brightest science and math students in the New York area, and I was given a grant by the National Science Foundation to study astronomy and space science in the Hayden Planetarium in New York. So I would take a train into New York City every day, and I had the top astrophysicists in the world teaching me at Hayden Planetarium in order for me to go study aerospace engineering and build rockets and missiles. So here I am watching
something. How old were you when you were doing that?
15.
All right. You were a boy genius, weren't you?
So, well, you know, the thing was, is I couldn't concentrate at all, but when you're interested in something, you can concentrate. So you do well in what you're interested in, but it's the other stuff you have trouble with. But, you know, I'm looking at that, and I'm going, oh, my God. And I could not get over it. I couldn't forget it. And so we went back to the hotel, and we found out, we asked the various people that the Hilton Hotel there in San Juan, we asked them, we saw a UFO. Did anybody else see it? And nobody else saw it. And we're like, well, why is that? And then we found out that in the El Yucatan rainforest, they see flying saucers all the time. They're always glowing orange.
Well, you know, that area was prone to UFO cases all the time.
Well, I know, and it's got the Puerto Rico Trench is one of the deepest parts of any ocean in the world.
That's right.
So, you know, and then you find those things to the west of Cuba, where maybe Atlantis is, half a mile down, and it's in the Bermuda Triangle, and but the thing is that changed everything for me. And by the time I was in my my junior year, Princeton called me up, and they had gotten my name from the National Science Foundation people, and they wanted me to go to Princeton to study aerospace engineering.
They were going to give you a scholarship?
Well, no, my father had enough money that nobody was going to give me a scholarship.
Yeah.
So, but I did take the National Merit Qualifying Test, and I missed that by 1 point to get a scholarship. But I didn't want a scholarship. I didn't need a scholarship. My father was going to, pay. But anyway, for some reason, I was a total idiot, and I decided not to go to Princeton, and I went to the University of Virginia instead.
Well, that's not a bad school.
No, but, you hear about tenured professors that are old fuddy-duddies that, listen, I talk in an interesting way because that's how I learn, and that's how I want people to talk to me. And I was falling asleep in the class, and I'm thinking, no, honestly. And
not that have you get a bad professor, it's horrible.
Oh, I had every single one of them was like, I don't know where they came from. You know, I've seen flying saucers. I've had these experiences, and they're talking about, it was awful. So, I thought, and I'd read Edgar Cayce, and it had a really strong impression on me that the scientists are responsible karmically for the weapons that they create. And I thought, why are we trying to build missiles when I saw something sitting there with no propulsion, no exhaust, no noise, just sitting there in the sky, launching three saucers out the side of it that obviously had no propulsion and no noise, and there's something else going on here, and the aliens already know what it is. Now, one of the first books I started reading, I love to read, and my father had bought every UFO book as it came off the press. So probably it was 1953 or 1956, I read my first UFO book on Roswell.
Well, see, these were the classic books at the time. You were probably seeing stories from Edward Ruppelt.
Yes. Yeah, my father had bought all of those. So, and he was a voracious reader, and that's what he was interested in. And he's working out of New York, so he had access to all these books when they came out. Because you go into your average bookstore in your town, and you're not going to see these kinds of books on the shelf.
No, you're not going to see that. I mean, tucked away now in the New Age section.
Right, so I thought, it's going to be a long time before the U.S. government and the universities are going to catch up to this story. And another thing I had started, when I said I started working at age 11, my mother was asked to take some pictures of a house tour, and she said, here's the camera, you take them. So I got paid $5 a picture, and I'm 11 years old, and I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty good. So I went on to all through high school. I worked for four newspapers, and I made quite a good living. And so I took a year of architecture at the University of Virginia, and then I dropped out. And I became a professional photographer in New York and L.A., and I had lots of pictures published. I was the only white man present at the second time that all the Indian tribes in North America got together as one Indian nation. And that was in between Banff and Calgary, is a place called the Stoney Indian Reserve.
All right. Well, let's get you on track here.
Okay.
Let's find out a little bit about the exposure now to Zeta, and how that started to affect you with Planet X. What happened?
Well, you see, in 1973, I had this dream that the tide was coming up. Every high tide was 6 inches higher than the tide before it. And then to read in Zeta Talk that they said that the final, after all the ice is in the wrong place and it melts, the oceans are going to come up 675 feet. And they're going to do that 6 inches per high tide for about almost 2 years. So I was like flabbergasted, because how would I know that? I mean, In my dream, I got a plane and I flew to where I grew up, which was also a mountain in Connecticut, and I landed on a field that was 600 feet above sea level. And I thought, well, I only have a little bit of time before I've got to get back on that plane and fly out of here, else this is going to be underwater too. So I even got the elevation, the final elevation, right. So it's things like that. When I started looking into Zeta Talk, I'm like, oh my God. And in 1990, well, in 1968, I decided to teach myself telepathy. And I used to have an idea about a cold emotional approach to, you know, astral travel, remote viewing, telepathy. And I gradually learned that it was the feeling. Have you ever launched a basketball at a basket, and as you do it, or even before you do it, you know the basket's going to go through the hoop?
Well, with me shooting, not very often.
Okay, but you've had that experience where you get that feeling, I just know it's going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the emotion. That's the feeling. And without that, you can't do it. And what the key to this is developing empathy, because at the end of this lifetime, you can't take money with you. You can take your skills with you to your next lifetime, like if you become a great artist or whatever. But the only thing that really counts is caring for other people. And you learn it sooner or you learn it later, but that is the single most important thing. And that's why I think that everything that's going on in the world today is like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah, but it's changing, and it's changing dramatically. But the big question is, why?
Well, I think that NASA has known for years that this was going to happen. I would estimate they probably knew this for 50 years. I think they knew when they launched that IRIS satellite to go look for Planet X in 1983 or 1982, they built it to look for Planet X. I am absolutely convinced of that. And when they twice detected it, and then announced on the front page of the Washington Post in December 1983 that they found it. In the article, they say, well, this is not like incoming mail. I want to douse cold water on that right now. And that was the scientist from Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And people don't realize NASA builds the spaceships, but the navigation, the math that tells where the spaceship should go is all from JPL. So you can't tell me they didn't know exactly what it was doing if they tracked it two times, 6 months apart. And to put that in there, they must have thought, well, you know, we'll just tell people no danger, it's not coming here. But that night, you know, everybody must have said, what does it mean? You know, when are you going to know more? And they're thinking, oh God, we shouldn't have even said a word. So the next day they retracted it. And when is the last time you heard NASA retract anything?
NASA never retracts, you know that.
Yeah, so now, they put up these two satellites called the SOHO satellites, and you can do a search on Google. Anyone can do this. And those pictures that the SOHO satellites, there's two of them. One's called the Ahead satellite, one's called the Behind satellite, because one is a little bit further in our orbit, and the other one is behind our orbit. And they photograph the sun at intervals like every 10 minutes, and then they download the pictures to the internet. Well, for 7 years now, they've been getting pictures of Nibiru, Planet X, the winged globe, the planet of crossing. And, you know, they don't get it every picture, but any one of your listeners can go to that site and just watch for the latest download. And if it's there, then you can right-click on it and save it. And that's where all these pictures that come from.
Are you convinced that there is another planet in the solar system?
It's not in orbit to the sun. You see, if you could just reach up in the sky and take the solar system, it would be like a pancake, and you could just lay it up right on a table. And it all turns, all the north, the axes of all the planets and the sun, the polar axes all point up. So the north pole of every planet and the sun all points up. So, and it's turning counterclockwise and zooming into the solar system is Planet X laid over so that its north pole is like a headlight on a train, on a freight train. And it comes in, and as it approached the sun during what was supposed to be the historical quiet period, it caused the sun to erupt massively. Now, to me, Al Gore is lying, or was and is lying, about global warming, because the thing is if it was global warming and if CO2 made one damn bit of difference, that does not explain why all the ice on the moon, the Mars is melting, why Jupiter had one red spot, which is the storm, for 350 years, and now it's got three, why Uranus and Neptune, which if you've ever seen are a beautiful blue color, changed color. I mean, it was the satellites. Well,
the planets are heating up. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen from CO2 on Earth.
No.
So what it did was it came in from the direction of Orion, and that's where it was when the IRIS satellite photographed it. Then the first time that a telescope on Earth got a picture of it was in 1999 from Earth. And then it came in from Orion, and it came to the left of the sun, behind the sun, around to the right of the sun, and it's going clockwise. So it's in the plane of the ecliptic, in that pancake, and it crossed over into the Earth orbit in front of the sun, and it came to a stop. And in front of it, facing its north pole, is Venus and the Earth. And that's why it stopped. And the Earth stopped in its orbit. Now, I was trained as an astrologer, and I haven't been doing charts for years because I'm like, well, something is not right about this. And I'll tell you, NASA has been taking pictures with these SOHO satellites since 2003. And Planet X is four times the size of Earth, and it has two strands of moons behind it, just like a rope, like two strands of a rope. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds of moons, and most of them that are near Planet X are the size of our moon. So, and behind that are trillions of rocks, clouds of iron ore dust, and greasy hydrocarbons, because Planet X is a volcanic, oceanic, and atmospheric planet with selfish extraterrestrials on it, the ones who Zechariah Sitchin wrote about. And they're banned from coming here. So what you have is we're going to have pole shift, and that's why anyone can contact extraterrestrials. There's two things, though. You have to know, like attracts like. If you're selfish and you put out a call that you would like to contact ETs, guess what kind you're going to meet?
The same kind, right?
Yeah. And if you're unselfish, well, you could look at Earth as a dark planet surrounded by clouds of greed and violence and anger. And people who have made a conscious choice to be unselfish have big, bright auras. They're like candles in the darkness. The extraterrestrials, the unselfish ones, have already identified all of them, all of you.
When do you expect the shift, the pole shift, to occur?
Well, I don't have a time calendar as much as I have an event calendar. And the events in order of what happens is that the Pacific is about to narrow and the Atlantic is about to widen. South America, the northern side of it, is about to tip over to the left.
Let's go through some of those events, Gordon, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.